Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Stephen V. Roberts, whose new book is Cokie, A Life Well Lived. And Megan Holt previews Words and Music, A Literary Feast in New Orleans. It is such a pleasure to welcome Steve Roberts to The Reading Life. He is the author of In My Father's Houses and co-author with his wife Cokie Roberts of From This Day Forward. He is the chief political analyst for the ABC radio network and a professor of journalism and politics at George Washington University, as well as a syndicated columnist. Today we're talking about his beautiful and loving new book, Cokie, A Life Well Lived. Steve Roberts, welcome, and thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Susan.
What a loving work of memory this is, memories of 53 years together. And you were motivated not just by honoring Cokie's many professional achievements, but by her less well-known private acts of kindness and consideration. And you had a very good motivation for that, didn't you?
Well, I did, for two reasons, really. After she died, I gave a eulogy at the cathedral here in Washington. And my only purpose was to tell stories. And I was so touched and overwhelmed, really, by the reaction I got from folks who just wanted to hear more Cokie stories. And I had them. So I thought that there was a book to be written here. But the other factor is, as you mentioned, it's pretty well known that she was this enormously important symbol to so many women and girls over so many years. I've heard so many stories of people saying, my mother said to me, be like Cokie Roberts. She's the model. One young woman from New Orleans, Ariane Nolte, very well-known New Orleans family, who told me that when she first went to work at ABC as a producer, her parents said to her, just be like Cokie. Do everything Cokie does. And I heard that story countless times, not just from people who knew her, like the Nolte family, and Boggs and Nolte's been close for years, but also, you know, from immigrants. I had a student whose parents were immigrants from India. And growing up, this woman said, my mother would say to me, and then watch the television and say, that's who you, I want you to be like. You can be smart like her. You can be strong like her.
Wow.
There was this enormous legacy of the public Cokie.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have always known and is that there was always a private Cokie, too. This is a woman, Susan, who did something good for somebody else every single day of her life.
Right.
And these private acts of generosity and consideration, in some ways, even more significant than the public Cokie, because as I say in the book, not everybody can be a TV star or a radio star. Everybody can be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can learn something about how to lead a good life from the stories and examples that she set. And so, in many ways, that to me is even more important dimension of her life to tell than all the celebrity and all the fame that she garnered.
And I think you tap into something very powerful here, because I think when we lose someone, what we want is more. That is what we always want, more time, more stories. And that's what you've given us, more time with her and more stories about her to keep a legacy alive and you pass it along, which is really a grand undertaking.
Well, there are many stories in this book, some of which involve New Orleans.
As I'm
sitting here at my desk, I'm sitting in the house that Cokie and I shared for 42 years, but this was a house here in Bethesda, suburban Washington, that her parents, Hale and Lindy, bought in 1952. In 1951, Hale ran for governor of Louisiana and lost. And he was still a member of Congress. Of course, the listeners know, you run for governor because Louisiana has off-year elections.
Mm-hmm.
House seat, which is what he did. And once he lost, the family decided that they would, their lives would be focused on Congress. And so they moved here for most of the year, and Cokie and her brother and sister enrolled in school here. But Cokie never lost her love for New Orleans, never lost her connections to the city and to the state, had many relatives there. Of course, her mother eventually moved back to New Orleans and had a famous house on Bourbon Street.
Oh, yeah.
To visit it. But I'm looking right now, and this is accidental. I didn't plan this. I'm looking right now at a photograph that was taken on the day of her mother's funeral. Of course, the funeral mass was at St. Louis Cathedral.
Yeah.
There was a reception at the Cabildo next door. And in the lobby of the Cabildo, as guests were coming in for the reception after the funeral, there was a jazz band and a second line. I'm looking at a photo of Cokie holding a parasol, dancing to this jazz band in the threshold of the Cabildo on the morning of her mother's funeral. And that's how she celebrated her mother's life, with dancing on the second line in New Orleans.
Very New Orleans way. And she never forgot where she came from. I mean, one of the things I think so many people are eternally grateful to her for is the way she remembered New Orleans and was a strong voice for New Orleans, especially after Katrina, when New Orleans needed all the explicators we could find in the national media, you know?
She was a very loyal person.
And, yes.
But also she had a great sense of history. And some of your listeners know, Susan, her direct ancestor, W.C.C. Claiborne, was the first governor of Louisiana, appointed by Thomas Jefferson in 1803 after the Louisiana Purchase. And then he eventually became the first elected governor of Louisiana. And her mother's family, the Claibornes, this was Cokie's middle name and her mother's
right
name. And of course, everybody knows Claiborne Avenue is said to be the longest street in the city of New Orleans. But beyond that, there have been many members of her family over many generations who served in public life. W.C.C., before he was appointed governor, had been a congressman from Tennessee. In fact, there's a wonderful story in the book. There was a fellow named Steve Hess who writes history books at the Brookings Institution here, and he set about trying to devise a rating system to rate the prominence of different families in American history. And so, and he would assign a point value to each member of a family who had served in public office. And so the Claibornes, in his original ranking, came in third in American history behind the Roosevelts and the Kennedys, well ahead of the Adams and many others. Cokie looked at his list and said, "Steve, you forgot about half a dozen of my relatives." In a very typical fashion, she forced him to recalibrate his rankings, and now the Claibornes are number two. They're ahead of the Kennedys and second only to the Roosevelts, and it's unfair because the Roosevelts had two presidents. So, I mean, you know, it's hard for the Claibornes to match that. But this is her legacy, you know, and this is her. And it was no accident that she wound up not only covering politics for NPR and ABC, but then writing these books about American history and focused on resurrecting and reviving enormous but often untold contributions that women have made to American history from time out of mind. And one of the reasons why she was so inspired to do this, as she said many times, and as I write about in the book, she saw these women in action. She saw her own mother serve that role for her father. She saw her mother's friends, Lady Bird Johnson, do this for President Johnson, Pauline Gore do it for Senator Gore, Betty Ford do it for President Ford. She grew up with these powerful, important, influential women, contemporary women. So when she started researching the history, you know, she could understand Dolly Madison because Dolly Madison reminded her of Lindy Bob.
Exactly. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen V. Roberts, whose new book is Koki, A Life Well Lived. Well, one of the things this book reminded me of is the powerful arc of her life. I mean, when she was young, she couldn't have imagined the life she would have eventually because it didn't exist yet. You know, and NPR is the perfect example of that because it had so many opportunities for women. But it began during her lifetime. So she was making up a lot of this as she went along, improvising and adapting.
That's true, and was out with very few role models to guide her. And that's one of the reasons why she felt so profoundly responsible for providing those models for young women coming along after her. And this is the private side of Koki. Her office at first at NPR and then at ABC, I mean, it was like a therapist's office. She could have had a shingle out there. Young women were lined up down the corridor waiting to talk to her because they were so hungry for models. They were hungry for advice. They were hungry for encouragement. They were hungry for support. I heard stories that I've never heard before because as much as I loved her and as close as well as I knew her for 53 years of marriage, I was not there, Susan.
Yeah.
When she was in that office consoling young women or counseling them, I was not there when she showed up at every single maternity ward when any one of her young friends had a baby. I was not there when she went to the funeral of her friend's parents. I was not there when she sat outside hospital rooms when her friends had operations for cancer. There were so many of these moments that I knew in general how devoted she was to her friends, but I heard stories I had never heard. I'll tell you just one.
Sure.
There was a young woman who worked at ABC, an African-American woman named Sonia McNair, who actually started, she was a receptionist. She wasn't even a real producer. But Koki befriended her. And when Sonia was very young, there was a series of tragedies in her family, and she wound up being the only caretaker for an abandoned child, a baby. The mother had been killed. The grandmother died. And she constantly went to Koki for advice of how to raise this child, and he had some learning disabilities. She was worried that he was being sidelined because of his race, and Koki just held her hand and kept her going and got her through these tough years of being a young single mom of a child that wasn't even around. And then Sonia's brother died, and it was a shock to the family. He had been a D.C. policeman, and there was a funeral at a big black church in downtown Washington. And Sonia describes this scene in the middle of the day, and she looks up, and at the head of the church, in walks Koki Roberts, the only white person in this church.
Mm.
And she walks slowly down the center aisle with everybody watching her. She gets to Sonia's family and embraces Sonia's mother. And Sonia says, "It was like my two moms embracing."
Well, there are so many stories in this book, and the great cumulative effect of all of it is that it's very joyful and it's very funny in so many parts. And isn't that kind of what you hoped for in the end?
Absolutely. Look, I spent a year and a half after Koki's death writing this book, and people have asked me, you know, how did you do it? I said, well, it was my way of grieving, it was my way of mourning, but it was also my way of celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd cry at some stories, I'd laugh at others. No one made me do this book. I embraced it. I wanted to because it was a way of, as I say, of remembering and mourning. But also, I just wanted to share the stories. There are so many great ones. There's another one about Louisiana that I told at her funeral. She goes to the state penitentiary in Angola, and she's there to receive an award in her mother's name. Actually, after the ceremony, the warden holds a lunch, and the chef for the lunch is a man named Big Lou, who is like serving three consecutive life sentences for murder. But he's the chef at Angola, and he produces this wonderful meal that features a crawfish cornbread. And Koki just loved this crawfish cornbread, and she got Big Lou to write out the recipe for her, and she brought it home. Koki was a wonderful cook, and she specialized in a lot of New Orleans dishes. Then she added this to her repertoire of New Orleans dishes. literally, Susan, on the last day that she was conscious, she was already in the hospital. She was obviously very sick. And I was called her as I was preparing to leave to visit her in the hospital, saying, is there anything that you want me to bring? And she says, yes, Stephen, I want you to find this recipe of Big Lou's cornbread because I want to give it to one of my nurses. And I said, oh, honey, really? Stephen, go to my recipe box, and I stuffed it in the top of the recipe box, and you can find it, and I want it. Okay, dear. So I go to the recipe box. I found the recipe, and I actually made several copies of it and brought it in. And she wanted to give it to one of her nurses because, again, she thought the nurse might enjoy this. And another one of her nurses was pregnant with a third child and had two other children. So Cokie had been bugging her. I want to see pictures of those children, Letitia. And finally, and this was literally the last day I saw her, virtually the last thing I ever heard her say. The nurses were going off shift at around 6 o'clock. We were preparing to leave the hospital room. And she says to the nurse, I want to see those pictures of those kids. And so finally, okay, Cokie. And she brings over her phone and shows her these pictures. And these kids have been at a wedding or something, and they were all dressed up. They're totally adorable. And through the pain, she lost a lot of weight. She was in great pain. And yet, out broke this classic Cokie smile. It lit up her face. And she reaches up and embraces the nurse and says, oh, what beautiful children. And this was so typical of her. With her last, virtually with her last bit of energy, she was embracing somebody else. She was praising somebody else. She was encouraging somebody else. She was complimenting somebody else. And that's what she did every single day of her life.
And she shared the joy with so many people. We are all so lucky. We've been talking with Steve Roberts, whose wonderful new book is Cokie, A Life Well Lived. Steve, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure talking to you and sharing with you these stories.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Megan Holt, Executive Director of Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans, which is coming up fast this November. Megan, you have a great lineup this year. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me again this year.
Now, I think we all hoped we'd be gathering in person this year, but no. So tell us about some of the factors that went into choosing the format for this year.
Honestly, while I'm the executive director, I have an amazing team of community partners and steering committee members. Mm-hmm. And because Words and Music really belongs to the community, it doesn't just belong to One Book, One New Orleans, I asked them, I said, what do you guys want to do? How would you feel safe? And 87% of the vote that we took was have it virtually and keep everyone safe. So I leaned on my people to know what they wanted to do, and I trust our people implicitly.
Well, that's a pretty significant percentage. I mean, you have to go with it.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the mission of this event, because Words and Music has always had several missions, I think, in the community. So talk a little bit about that for us.
So all proceeds from Words and Music go to benefit One Book, One New Orleans free literacy outreach and community programming. Basically, what One Book, One New Orleans does is we provide books for adult education programs throughout the greater New Orleans area, and we host free accessible community programming throughout the year. So Words and Music is not just something that benefits us 4 days a year. Words and Music proceeds benefit us all day long. And it also goes towards uplifting those artists in the community who are sometimes overlooked, right? Because as one book. We focus on one book the whole year. But Words and Music gives us the opportunity to really celebrate so many local artists and writers and musicians that we couldn't focus on during one book programming.
So this year in particular, you have such a great schedule. So tell us about some of your favorites.
Oh my goodness, there are so many favorites that I can't pick just one. So I'll hit a couple of highlights.
Sure.
In 2017, as you know, our book was Clint Smith's Counting Descent, the one book selection. And we're so excited this year to feature Clint's new book as our keynote address, How the Word is Passed. So Clint will read from that book, and then he will be interviewed by Dr. David Robinson Morris. We also have a conversation that I cannot wait for, curated by Kelly Harris DeBerry. Her recent article in 64 Parishes talks about how Casanova, the song, became a brass band standard. So Kelly has pulled together members of Rebirth and the only surviving member of the Levert Trio that originally recorded Casanova, together with DJ Soul Sister, and they're going to talk about how Casanova became a song that you cannot escape at a brass band performance.
I think that's such a great idea.
Right? And it really does sort of fit in with Words and Music, because Kelly, as we know, is a poet and an essayist, and the musicians do their thing. So it really does sort of lend itself to our festival in a really beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as always, we have workshops. We have a couple this year. One on writing your community's history with author Fatima Shank, who is known locally and beloved Native New Orleanian. And another on the personal essay by author Athena Dixon. And both of those sort of speak to our theme this year, which is our stories, our time. And they lend themselves to storytelling and history and a sense of place, which I think is a theme permeating throughout all of the programming this year.
And then you'll close with a special evening with a really special person, too.
Absolutely. Dr. Mona Lisa Saloy is the brand new Louisiana Poet Laureate, and she's closing with a reading and maybe also a couple of surprises as well.
Well, Mona Lisa has been known to burst into song, too, so.
Exactly.
You never know.
Exactly. Can I tell you how excited I was when she became Poet Laureate? She's
I know.
A wonderful person.
Now, where can people go for tickets and information?
Wordsandmusic.org.
All right. We've been talking with Megan Holt, Executive Director of Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans. So many great writers to hear November 17th through 20th. Don't miss it. Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. And just a reminder, with evolving COVID restrictions, best to check with venues before attending in-person events. And be sure to mask up when required. In New Orleans, Emily Reese discusses and signs New Orleans Music Observed, The Art of Noel Rockmore and Emily Reese, and appears in conversation with curator David Koonian. Friday, November 5th at 6 at the New Orleans Jazz Museum, 400 Esplanade Avenue. Barbara Heller discusses and signs Little Women, the complete novel, featuring letters and ephemera from the characters' correspondence, written and folded by hand. That's Saturday, November 6th from 1 to 3 at Octavia Books. Barbara will be signing the books along with the calligraphers, all from New Orleans, who reproduce the letters. Sally Weisinger discusses and signs her memoir, Yes Again, Misadventures of a Wishful Thinker. Saturday, November 6th from 3 to 4:30 at Octavia Books. Robert Mann signs Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. Saturday, November 6th at 2 at Blue Cypress Books. Lewis Edwards discusses and signs Ramadan Ramsey, just selected as one of Publishers Weekly's Best Books of the Year, Tuesday, November 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Going on now, the Louisiana Book Festival has gone virtual this year, from now to November 13th, with new and free content every weekend. Check out LouisianaBookFestival.org for the complete schedule. Among the authors set to appear are Louisiana Writer Award winner Fatima Sheikh, Louisiana State Poet Laureate Mona Lisa Saloy, James Gill, Howard Hunter, Ricky Lee Jones, Alicia Long, Josh Prager, Stephen Roberts, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, and many, many more. And coming up, the Preservation Resource Center is bringing together local authors for a celebration of their latest books, focused on New Orleans history, architecture, and culture. That's at the PRC Holiday Book Fest, Saturday, November 13th from 11 a.m. to 2 at the Hotel St. Vincent's Evangeline Hall, 1507 Magazine Street, free. Each author will give a 15-minute talk followed by a book signing. Authors include Robert Cangelosi, author of New Orleans Architecture, Volume 9, Carrollton, Dr. Stephen Hales, author of Rex, 150 Years of the School of Design, Danielle Del Sol and John Pope, co-authors of Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans, Macon Frye, author of They Called Us River Rats, The Last Bachelor Settlement of New Orleans, Sandy Rosenthal, author of Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina, Deb Shriver, author of The French Lee, From Paris to Orleans Parish, and finally, Sue Strachan, author of The Café Brûlot. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.